today.
But he said, I don't know whether you're interested in any elaboration of technical points of papers that I feel especially were significant at the time I wrote them. I don't mean technical elaboration, but reference to research activities as against reference to formal responsibility for things.
I think we'd like to discuss both of those. I'm interested in the background that led to the paper, and as well as your other responsibilities. I think that we're probably ready to get started then.
All right. Have you had any test of whether this is working or
yes,
not?
Yes, I can hear it very well right through here.
All right.
And you're coming across very well. All right. This is James J. Boning of the Center for History of Chemistry interviewing Professor Hoyt C. Hoddle on November 18th, 1985 in Professor Hoddle's office on the MIT campus. Professor Hoddle, you were born in January 15th, 1903 in Salem, Indiana. Can you tell me something about your parents, their names, their occupation?
Yes. Salem is about 40 miles north of Louisville. My father's name was Louis Weaver Hoddle. He went to Indiana University, but dropped out the first year because he and my mother had both gone there, and they were already married, and he was having to work to help support them, and he couldn't carry both the work and that, and so he dropped out that first year. He later got into sales in the rubber industry and was sales manager for a succession of small to middle-sized rubber companies in the days when there were many of them, and many of them going under in the days when rubber was up and down in price. My mother's name was Myrtle Clark. They were both 21 when they were married.
What year was that?
They must have been married in 1901 because they were both born in 1880, and I was born in 1903. I didn't live in Salem long. My father and mother took me to a suburb of St. Louis when I was a baby of a year or so. That was when the World's Fair was going on in St. Louis. And for years I had memory of that, and these early memories, you know they're not real. You have memory of memories.
Mm-hmm.
Memory of discussion with parents of what you remembered, and the Boer imitation Boer War in the St. Louis Exposition scared the life out of me. A lot of cannon and thunder and lightning, but that memory is not real.
Do you have any siblings?
No, I'm an only child with 12 grandparents, with 12 grandchildren. I had four children, and one of them had four, and two of them had three, and one of them had two, so I have 12 grandchildren. It seems like a mob to an only child, and it is a mob. Enjoy each other enormously.
You mentioned that you went to St. Louis when you were a year old. Did you stay in St. Louis?
I stayed in St. Louis until I was, 9 and a half, I guess. So I went through several grades in grammar school in the suburban town of Maplewood. And then, because my father's business was changing from St. Louis to Chicago, and my mother's mother in Salem, Indiana, was quite ill, my mother took me to Salem to kind of take care of her mother and her illness while my father was changing positions from St. Louis to Chicago. And so I was enrolled in the small town school in Salem and went through the sixth grade there. A very stimulating year. A superb arithmetic teacher who had won prizes in state competitions, and a good music teacher, and an awfully good teacher of English, a Burl Kaufman, who was the sister of Lotus Kaufman, who became president of the University of Minnesota. Burl Kaufman was a superb teacher and a personally awful person who I disliked enormously, but it's a prime example to me of the fact that sometimes you can learn an awful lot from somebody you don't like. And the fact that I could parse sentences and draw diagrams of their structure in my sixth grade caused me years later, as a sophomore in high school in Chicago, to have the teacher say I could skip a year of English with credit because I had no need of instruction in sentence structure. And that was from the sixth grade. Well, from the sixth grade in Salem, Indiana, I went to Chicago, and my mother took me there. I was still pretty young. Was I 10 years old? And she said I was ready for the seventh grade. And the principal smiled and said, well, we'll see. And they put me in the fourth grade. I was terribly depressed. My mother left by this time. But she did speak to the teacher without my knowing what she said. And the teacher would ask questions, and I would raise my hand and answer. And it was not 10 minutes before the teacher took me to the fifth grade. And the same thing happened, and the teacher took me to the sixth grade, and that teacher took me to the seventh grade. So within the first hour in Chicago, I got into the grade I said I belonged in the seventh grade, where there was a Miss Reed, a matronly woman, awfully pleasant person, and a moderately good teacher. And then in the eighth grade, I got Isabella King as my teacher, the strangest, most improbable teacher you could imagine, and one of my very stimulating teachers. Isabella had one glass eye. She wore a wig, red-haired wig, and she was a drunkard. And there were times when Miss Reed had to take care of the seventh and eighth grade, because Isabella was messing up things, and her desk would be had smashed tomato on it, and her wig on sideways, and an awful situation that would not be allowed today. But when Isabella was not drunk, she was a superb teacher, and she used to try to stimulate me on my math and give me extra problems when others were too easy. I remember a lecture once of hers on spending an evening with some Indian. I guess you'd call him a guru these days. And she had been impressed by him, and she tried to impress us. Well, I went from there to Hyde Park High School, and that was, to my mind, Chicago's best of some 55 high schools. And I went through Hyde Park in 3 years so that I was ready for university when I was 15. And I thought a bit of going to Armour Institute, now Illinois Tech, but I was too young to be accepted. So I went to Indiana University, where my parents had gone and where I had uncles who had graduated.
What year was that then that you went to Indiana?
That was in 1918, a few months before the armistice. And the armistice occurred in November of my first year at Indiana University.
When you went,
go ahead.
When you went to Indiana, what major did you select?
Well, I should say that my father, in the rubber industry, was aware of the sad state of knowledge of vulcanization. My father should have been an engineer or a scientist. He was a thoughtful, inquiring person, a superb soft sell salesman whose technique was never asked for an order but to talk about the problems of the company he was talking to. And he was impressed by a man named Swinehart, who had started up a tire company, the Swinehart Tire, and had been the chief chemist or advisory chemist, I'm not sure which, to Goodyear. And Swinehart had convinced my father that better knowledge of rubber vulcanization was important. And so I went to Indiana expecting to be a rubber chemist, or my father thought I should be, and I wasn't against it.
So I
took the freshman chemistry class.
Who was the instructor?
And,
do you remember?
Well, R. E. Lyons. Frank Mathers was the instructor, and I should say a bit about Mathers in that first year because it did stimulate me. At the end of 1 week, I decided I wanted an overload and I wanted to take qualitative analysis. But the registration office wouldn't permit an overload on the part of the freshman. I went to Mathers and talked with him. And he wrote out a comment. I don't remember the words, but I remember the points he made, and it was to the effect that this young man can take any size load he wants to take, and should be allowed to take any subject he wants to take. So they let me take qualitative analysis. And the assistant in qualitative analysis was one Jake Warner, who later became the president of Carnegie Tech. He wasn't stimulating then. It's just, to me, an accident that he was later president, but I got to know Jake very early. Mathers became a close friend and stimulant to me throughout the years. My sophomore year, I took a physical chemistry course under a Professor Brown, who was an awfully pleasant man, but not a good chemist. He would assign problems in a... We used Getman's book on physical chemistry, and Brown would assign problems, but nobody in the class except me did the problems, and he never discussed them in class. And he loved to get off on some aspect of storage batteries and talk about it. At the end of the term, he called me in and said I was a better student than he had realized I was, and I remember vividly my own reaction. Well, you just weren't aware of what was going on, or you would have known earlier, or something like that. I was annoyed at a compliment rather than pleased by it. My instruction in chemistry was not first class. Indiana University at that time did not have a good chemistry department. It later became very good, especially in physical chemistry. I forget the man whose book got widely used, but when I was there, it wasn't so good. But I did get a lot out of the university because I took a lot of other things. Logic and physiology, and I took a course in the law school in contracts, and the
what about mathematics course?
Professor
courses?
At the end of the contracts class called me in and asked, wouldn't I like to consider shifting from chemistry into law? I had an uncle who was an appellate judge of the appellate court at Indianapolis, and in fact my father's three brothers were all attorneys. He was the only one who was not a lawyer. What was your question?
Did you take any math courses?
Oh yes. My freshman year I took what was called college algebra. And I remember once asking goodness, I've got a mental blank on the name of the chemist, Rothrock, David Rothrock. My father had taken math when he was at Indiana University under David Rothrock, and I had a course under him. And I remember, toward the end of the term, I asked the question, class, is there any use of this math that we've been studying? A good teacher, of course, would just wish he had several students planted who'd ask such questions. But Rothrock's reply was, no, it's just good intellectual exercise. That was the end of his question, of his answer. Well, it was later that I found out how wrong he was. I have skipped some high school instruction. I got my best stimulation in the sixth grade in Salem, Indiana, and in Hyde Park High School in Chicago, where I had Abulah Shoesmith as the math teacher.
Could you spell the last name?
B-E-U-L-A-H-S-H-O-E-S-M-I-T-H. Fellowships have been set up in the name of Abulah Shoesmith at the University of Chicago. She was recognized as the best teacher. She was the highest paid teacher in Chicago. But let me go back and tell the story of Eula in a little better sequence. My freshman year, I took algebra with her. And early in the term, he gave a problem. A man is twice as old as his wife was when he was as old as she is now. Together, their ages add to 100. How old were they? And that's a nice one to illustrate the use of algebra. This wasn't an assignment. It was just an extra thing. I was a couple of days thinking about it before I got straight on it. And I was amused and pleased that I got straight. We were, then the second year, my sophomore year at Hyde Park, I took geometry. And that was a beautifully taught course. Miss Shoesmith also taught it. Before I go to it, let me end the first year of University High School in Chicago. Believed in combining geometry and algebra, and Beulah Shoesmith did not. And they had annual contests between the students, and Hyde Park had always won the contests. Hyde Park had over 2,000 students. Miss Shoesmith was in charge of all the many math teachers. And to get ready for this contest at the end of the first year, the algebra year, each teacher would gather together the better students and drill them a little and send one or two of them to Miss Shoesmith, and she would start with 30 or 40 students out of a freshman class of 700 or 800, after the first day it was down to a dozen, and after the second session it was down to team, I guess. I forget how many sessions it took. Anyway, we ended up with a team of six. And, I was chairman of the team. We won hands down from University High School. Then in the geometry year, Miss Shoesmith did not use a textbook. She had a little blue syllabus, 1/8 inch thick, of propositions and corollaries. And she would give hints on the next proposition to prove, but by the time I got through the geometry year, I had this feeling, well, if Euclid hadn't written it, I could have written geometry, and there were several of us who felt this same way. Early in the term, there was a special event. She said, I'm going to give you 207 today. You've had enough background so that you should be able to prove 207. And I've been giving it for a good many years. 2 years ago, so-and-so, I forget his name, now on his doctorate in mathematics at the University of Chicago. I guess not on his doctorate yet. He'd gone there to math. He got it. But obviously not many people had gotten it. 207. If two bisectors of angles are equal, prove that the triangle is isosceles. Now, the inverse of that is easy and straightforward. But from that direction, when you've only had a few weeks of geometry, it was quite a problem. And I never got it. Anybody who got it had got a grade of A for the year and could do as he pleased about coming to class. I was a freshman at Indiana University, walking across the campus near the well house in the middle of the campus, when it suddenly dawned on me how you got 207. And well, it's a little bit late, but I got it. Beulah went to Portland, Oregon my last year. And I took analytic geometry from somebody else. I forget. Mr. Smith. And I got a letter from Beulah from Portland. Would I please send her my papers turned in the geometry class, because she was having trouble showing the students how a good proposition should be proved. And so I sent her my papers. Many years later, when I had got the Walker Award of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, and it was meeting in Chicago, I called her up. She was by this time in her 70s, and we couldn't get together, but we had about a half an hour of talk, and she told me that the high school situation had saddened, that Chicago was not the place it had been when I had gone to high school. She was still teaching, although she was supposed to be retired. But there was not the freedom of action that you used to have. However, did I remember the Pythagorean Club? And I said, certainly I did. Henry Mathias was the president of it, and I was in it. Well, classes start at 9, but I meet with 30 boys at 8 every morning, and I'm giving them a course in the calculus. A 70-something-year-old woman.
When you were at Hyde Park, did you have any chemistry courses, chemistry or physics?
Yes. Under Mr. Alley, Dr. Alley. And I enjoyed it. I don't remember very much about it. I remember one incident. Henry Mathias, the same man who was the president of the Pythagorean Club, he and I were partners in a lab session, and it was on NO. What was that? I think it's NO forming, NO2, and you put in some more oxygen and you formed some more, and we started with NO and metered in some NO2, some O2, dissolved out, and kept adding what we calculated was the added sum, the oxygen necessary for the next step. I must say I'm too poor a chemist today to be straight on the story, but I remember that we decided we had an infinite series, and when we summed it, we got its sum, a simple geometric series. So we repeated the experiment with the right amount of oxygen for everything the first time, instead of calculating the stepwise process. That's all I can remember about my high school chemistry class. I took a physics class in high school, and the name of the physics instructor was Smith, and I remember he one time called me up to a board about something, and then he put me down on his knee and continued to talk, and I was terribly embarrassed sitting on a teacher's knee in front of the class.